There's a dead horse that needs to be.
So we're going to start. I'm going to call to order the Senate Interim Committee on General Government and Accountability for May 25th?
24th.
Thank you. First thing we're going to do is we're going to adopt some rules. It's the first time this committee's met, so we have to adopt rules.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, these committee interim committee rules are exactly what you have in other committees, but since this is our inaugural meeting, we need to adopt these committee rules.
Senator Thatcher.
Chair Riley, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Any objection? They're adopted. Thank you. So what do we have next?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, next up we have an informational meeting on the state radio project, the update and project description. So I think we just need to open an informational meeting and we can call up the first witnesses.
Okay, so we're going to open an informational meeting on a state radio project update, and if folks would come up, and thank you very much for being here. So whoever wants to start, just give us your name for the record and go for it.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today to talk about the state radio project. My name is Dick Upton, and I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation, where I manage the state radio project. With me is Rob Reisch, Wireless Communications Section Manager, also with ODOT. And together, we've been delivering the state radio project since July of 2011. And I'll start today with some insights on the complexity of the radio project, followed by a short project description. I'll share some of the challenges and then conclude by talking about our current status. Then Rob will share his perspective on the project and the radio system. So here I go. In terms of complexity, I've heard the complexity of our endeavor compared to rebuilding a car while running it in a race. The ODOT OSP radio system that we rebuilt was fully functional when we started. It was fully functional as we rebuilt it, and it will continue to be fully functional at a higher standard when we're done. At no time did we have broad outages while we dismantled some part of the system and put it back online. We did manage outages, but we managed at a micro level, one site at a time, one microwave hop at a time, one console station at a time. Our outages were measured in hours and minutes. They were very localized, and often because of redundancy or backup, resulted in no downtime for officers or maintenance workers. The intricacy of rebuilding a system while running at full throttle required very close partnership between the mechanic and the driver. That is why my opening remarks noted that Rob Reisch and I and our combined staff delivered this project together. It has been the dedication, determination, and collaboration of a lot of good people that generated the success we are now enjoying. And so a little bit about what we've been working on. Coming out of the 2011 legislative session, the scope of the $900 million Oregon Wireless Interoperability System to build an all-new statewide trunk radio system was set aside due to budget constraints. In its place, ODOT was authorized to pursue the state radio project to replace and upgrade the existing ODOT and OSP radio systems for an estimated cost of $209.9 million, which was later increased to $229 million, which is the current project budget. The authorized scope of the project included replacing all of the subsystems that comprise a radio system. I like to think of it from the ground up, starting with civil facilities that support the radio system, things like towers, shelters, power systems. On top of these facilities, we replaced the conventional radio system that is the two-way system used by ODOT and OSP throughout the state. This includes the mountaintop repeaters and the mobile and handheld radios that officers and maintenance workers speak into. Next would come the microwave system that carries these radio systems back to our control centers. The microwave is also often called the backhaul. Then at the control centers, there are consoles that dispatchers use to monitor the radio activity and direct communication. Then to keep track of the integrity of all of these systems, there is a remote monitoring system that allows the wireless communications section to monitor all components of the system from an operations center here in Salem. And the final piece, the ODOT OSP radio system, is actually an addition of new technology called the trunk radio system that takes advantage of digitized radio signals to use radio channels more efficiently. We added a trunk radio system in the higher use areas of the state, here in the Willamette Valley, up the Columbia River to the Dalles, and then down to Bend. It's the pattern we fondly refer to as the horseshoe. And to provide perspective on the size of the endeavor, there are 213 mountaintops with radio repeaters, 139 patrol or maintenance offices with radio equipment. We deployed over 5,500 mobile and handheld radios to officers and maintenance workers. And there are 6 dispatch centers with a total of 72 consoles to monitor and control radio traffic. So we've been replacing this system, or working on this, for nearly 5 years, and along the way we have found our share of challenges and successes. For example, in our first attempt to deploy mobile and handheld radios, we learned the value of testing. In the first set of radios we deployed, we encountered a pervasive radio programming error. Out of concern for officer and maintenance worker safety, we suspended deployment and took a 3-month detour while we reprogrammed the radios and then thoroughly tested before resuming deployment. We did carry that lesson forward and developed an implementation, testing, and rollout cycle that has delivered consistent success as we have rolled out other technology. On another front, the challenge that really drove the overall project timeline involved gaining legal access to place radio equipment at mountaintop sites. At each site, there are typically 3 principal entities: the landowner, a facility owner, which is the tower shelter power systems, and they generally lease from the landowner, and then the third entity is the tenants, the people with radio systems that want to place equipment in the facilities. ODOT is the landowner at only 3 sites throughout the state. We are the facility owner at about half of the rest of the sites, and we are actually tenants or lessors at the rest. So each time we change or add a facility, we have to update or create new agreements and or get new permits from resource agencies. We use standard scheduling timelines ranging from 6 months to 2 years, depending on complexity, and we rarely beat those timelines. Along the way, we accumulated a number of interesting anecdotes, like at one site, it took us 3 years to get an agreement with a private entity to place one of our simplest installations, one radio in the shelter, one antenna on the tower. In another case, on a federal site, we went through the process that took 2 years to get a permit to build. Then, just before we were ready to start building, there was a late discovery of a cultural resource. So we actually got to start that whole process over again. And that site took us 5 years to get the final permit to build. At yet another site, we actually abandoned our planned improvements when a legal dispute over the underlying land ownership was not headed for any kind of resolution in a time frame that we needed. So we moved to a different location. And the need to move to different locations was not uncommon. In places where we were placing new installations, we often had to evaluate multiple sites, often even combinations of sites. We performed our version of value engineering on the fly in order to optimize between technology needs, costs, and the ability to get legal access. Sometimes we found windfalls, like the ownership dispute I just mentioned. We rerouted microwave through a series of sites that we already occupied and ended up saving actually $200,000. That was a rare windfall. Usually it took investment to achieve our goals. And we have been achieving our project goals. At this time, most of the subsystems are on the order of 90% installed. By the end of this build season, all of the physical installations of civil infrastructure and technology will be complete. We are pre-testing the last major technology rollout now, which is the integration of all of the system components in the trunk radio area. The final proof of performance test in that area should begin the first week in June. Okay, and so now I might say the second week in June. Anyway, we will be rolling out the remaining areas in the fall. And by the end of the year, the updated ODOT OSP radio system should be fully operational. We will formal closeout of contracts, project documentations will continue through the winter and conclude by the end of the biennium in June of 2017. At this time, the project budget is also 90% expended. All of the contracts for technology implementation are in place and fully funded. All but one of the contracts for civil construction are also in place and all are fully funded. The project is currently carrying a $1.7 million contingency fund. However, we also have an active risk management program that indicates that most of that may be consumed by the known risks that lie ahead. In the end, the project trajectory is to finish slightly under budget. So the project is on track to meet the goals to replace and upgrade the ODOT OSP radio system as envisioned in 2011, both within budget and on our self-imposed timeline. And at this time, I will turn the microphone over to my colleague, Rob Reich, who manages the ODOT OSP radio system.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Rob Reich, Wireless Communications Section Manager for ODOT. I've been managing the ODOT and OSP radio systems for just over 10 years. The first ODOT and OSP radio systems were implemented in 1938, and these systems have been upgraded several times since then. The technology continues to evolve with new radios being built that provide better coverage, higher reliability, more efficiency, and new features. The system has been updated throughout the years with the last major upgrade in the 1980s when the agencies converted from low band to high band. The state radio project has now provided the next upgrade, an upgrade to trunk radio and digital technology. The SRP also funded the replacement of mobile and portable radios for both agencies, providing an opportunity to enhance interoperability with other agencies. So one major benefit from the project is the increased system reliability for our public safety radio users. It is important as the radio system can be their only lifeline for help. The enhanced reliability is in the form of backup power systems, more stringent tower loading specifications, new grounding standards, and other enhancements. We now have developed a fully redundant servers for our consoles, for our trunk radio system, and other support systems, and have geographically distributed the servers to Bend and Salem. Additionally, the microwave has circuit redundancy. We are in the process of implementing, as Dick had said earlier, a monitoring and alarm system for all the sites, giving our staff the ability to see potential issues well before they become an outage. And while there is no electronic system that is 100% fail-proof, the ODOT OSP radio system is at the highest level of reliability in its history. For example, during the storm of December 14, 2006, both ODOT and OSP lost a significant portion of its radio system, right at the time we needed it the most. A year later, during the storm of 2007, the system fared much better because we implemented changes based on the after-action review of the 2006 storm. These storms helped us to develop a guiding principle for systems reliability, and those principles were implemented in the scope of the state radio project. On December 9, 2014, wind gusts of 67 miles per hour hit PDX, the highest wind gust since 1981, leaving about 125,000 customers without power. The ODOT OSP radio system experienced no outage. With wind gusts at 67 miles per hour PDX, you might just imagine the wind speed at some of our coastal mountaintop sites, such as Tillamook Head or Megler or Nikolai Mountain. The upgrades are paying off. As part of any large system, we need to ensure that we account for systematic component replacement in our ongoing budget. Unlike the systems we just replaced, we'll not get 40 years of service out of this newer technology. The first estimate for the capital replacement is already taking place. For example, some older microwave will need to be replaced as early as 2020 as the manufacturer ceases to support the product after December 31st of that year. Now, these are part of the systems that were installed previous to the state radio project, but are still serviceable for the next few years. Capital funding includes the planned replacement of the dispatch consoles, microwave, power systems, radio, and other components. Over the next 18 years, it could reach up to $100 million or more. It is important we don't allow the system to deteriorate to the level where it takes hundreds of millions of dollars to replace. Now, interoperability with other agencies is vital to ODOT and OSP to support public and to conduct our daily work and our operations during disasters. In fact, we take interoperability very seriously. It's imperative we have communications with cooperators, not only for our normal work, but also for those large incidents. So some of the interoperability enhancements of the project include ensuring that all ODOT and OSP mobile and portable radios have multi-band capacity and capability. We share frequencies for mutual aid with 43 counties, 49 cities, 8 federal agencies, and 9 state agencies. There are 1,090 cooperator channels programmed into the ODOT and OSP radios to support interoperability for mutual aid. All additional interoperability includes all 110 of the federal interoperability channels are programmed into all of the ODOT and OSP radios. There are select OSP radios programmed on the Lane Regional Interoperability Group trunk system that support interoperability in Linn, Benton, and Lane counties. There are select OSP radios being programmed to operate on the Frontier Digital Network trunk system that support interoperability in Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler counties. We continue to enter into agreements with other agencies to program other agencies' frequencies into our radios and to allow other agencies to program ODOT and OSP frequencies into their radios. We also maintain 12 deployable interoperability radio caches strategically located throughout the state. Each cache includes 12 multiband radios, a programmable repeater, generator, solar panel, emergency supplies, a satellite phone, and satellite access to the internet. 8 of these caches are already reserved for the Cascadia Rising exercise early next month. And 2 of these caches are located here in Salem, and 2 are in Bend, and there's 1 each in Portland, The Dalles, La Grande, Ontario, Klamath Falls, Central Point, Eugene, Roseburg, and Warrenton. Additionally, we're implementing 60 cooperator talk groups on the new ODOT-OSP trunk radio system. This allows interoperability between the new ODOT-OSP trunk system and the existing cooperators who use conventional radio systems. And there are other interoperability projects being funded through the State Radio Project and prioritized and approved through the State Interoperability Executive Council. They include a direct connection between the Lane, Benton, and Linn County trunk system to the ODOT OSP trunk system. Deschutes County 911 is installing a countywide 800 megahertz simulcast interoperability channel. Polk County Emergency Management is installing a simulcast VHF system on interoperability channels. The Umatilla-Morrill Radio and Data District is adding VHF, UHF, and 700 megahertz regional interoperability repeaters. And funding has been provided to support the connection of the Frontier Digital Network trunk system to the ODOT OSP trunk system. So we're also pursuing interoperability strategies with other agencies such as City of Portland, Washington, and Clackamas counties, as well as others. We are laying the groundwork for connections to other systems. A recent partnership with Deschutes County 911 is operationally and financially advantageous to both entities. So the ODOT OS radio system does not provide any barrier to future interoperability throughout the state. In fact, the technology supports interoperability, but the capacity was designed for ODOT and OSP. However, it can be expanded to support future needs. This concludes my testimony.
Questions? So I've been on a couple of the mountaintops, and I've done ride-alongs in the cars that actually, some that have older radio systems and some that have the newer ones. And one of the things that strikes me is the data capabilities. Did the state radio system do anything with those data capabilities, or is it strictly voice?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, it is strictly a voice radio system.
Okay. Yes, Senator Thatcher.
Okay. I think we've been talking about, well, Owen, and now the project formerly known as Owen, and now the interoperability project for a long time, ever since at least 2005, I think is when it really
took off.
Started. Yeah. The legislature passed some. So did the mission remain somewhat the same? And that was to get all the emergency responders talking, being able to talk to one another. Did that remain the main goal? It was at the beginning. Did that change at all that you're aware of?
Senator Riley, Senator Thatcher, members of the committee, that did change.
Okay, that did change. All right. And that's why it's called the OSP ODOT trunk line. And it's, I guess it's kind of like you build it and then they come. Is that kind of the goal? Okay. And then they kind of like plug into what you have. And that's what you mean by expanding it.
So
maybe,
if I may, I think one of our next presenters will be able to talk about what's next and where do we go, which is, I think, what you're getting at.
Right.
So,
and
it's true that we really narrowed the scope when this was turned over to ODOT from statewide. We don't cover the entire state anymore because there are spots that don't have enough people in them that it warrants the expense. Is that correct?
Senator Riley, members of the committee, as part of the project, there was some expansion of the conventional radio system where we did take areas that had no coverage and added coverage to those areas for ODOT and OSP.
But not all.
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
Chair Riley and Senator Thatcher, the radio system that we started with provided coverage for ODOT and OSP for the entire state, with occasional zones where they weren't getting good coverage.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we replaced. What we didn't replace was the Owen goal to provide trunk radio system for all users, state users and local governments, mm-hmm. throughout the state. So it was that brand new big trunk radio system that we didn't do. We just fixed the ODOT OSP radio system.
Great. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, David, you can maybe fill us in on a little more.
I beg your pardon?
Maybe you can fill us in on a little bit more. Where are we headed?
First, thank you very much for inviting me to testify here today. My name is David Solis, S-O-L-O-O-S for the record. I'm the statewide interoperability coordinator, among other things. What we just heard from ODOT was about one radio system. The statewide interoperability coordinator was created in 2002 to deal with all of the radio systems and other public communications infrastructure and systems across Oregon. So to digress just a second, of course, Oregon is roughly 100,000 square miles according to Homeland Security. We have 530 primary first responder agencies in Oregon, and almost another 300 when you count the secondary agencies and jurisdictions that support them, such as hospitals and road departments and elected officials and so forth. And many of them have many different systems, as we know. Again, the ODOT system that we heard about is just one of many, many systems. What I try to do as the interoperability coordinator with the SIEC, the State Interoperability Executive Council, is to facilitate wise decisions towards interoperability across Oregon and among agencies. So many of our agencies work with one another without necessarily involving ODOT or OSP, for example. So we're sometimes granular at that level, sometimes at a larger level working with state agencies, and sometimes it's just state agencies. It's, you know, with that many responders in that many radio systems, it's fairly opportunistic, which is really good and sort of unfortunate. It would be nice to have some more resources to be able to also identify some need and go into some targeted need. Frequently, the greatest need is where we hear from people the least because they're busy keeping everything running to where. And so to address that, among other things, we are this year trying to embark on a deep dive study with a consultant with some surplus funds, one-time surplus funds we have, to study all and identify and inventory all of the agencies and all of the radio systems in Oregon. And that's a pretty big lift, but we're working on that right away. We hope to have that done by next spring, partly because that's when the funding for that is expires, and we hope to have that expire with a paid consultant with a very nice thorough report. With that too, we would like to hang on that a study of the what we call P25 trunked systems, of which there are, I believe, 12 or 13 in Oregon, and then study the ability of those to interoperate and what more it will take. So that's some of what we're after. And when I say we, again, it is the State Interoperability Executive Council, formed after, like it was in many, many states, formed after 9/11. The federal government came in with some statutes that indicated a lot of Homeland Security money would be available to states, but the quid pro quo was the states would have to create these commissions and have a statewide interoperability coordinator. So even though it was the right thing to do, and we were on that road anyway, the federal statute sort of jump-started that a bit. That has changed, as ODOT has mentioned, they've changed. The SIEC, the State Interoperability Executive Council, has also changed its focus. It does have policies. It leads by more example, and as opposed to having sticks, it's carrots about what we can do. Sometimes agencies just aren't able, because of the financial commitment, as much as they say may like, to get an advanced, modern, interoperable system. They just can't afford it, and they have the Sophie's choice of, do I provide a radio system that lets all my first responders speak to one another, or do we do this larger thing and start making sacrifices? And these radio systems are big ticket items, and unfortunately that jurisdiction had to make a decision, and they decided to have all of their first responders connected as opposed to connecting their system to larger systems, which makes sense, but that's the predicament they're in. And this does happen over and over, and we've all heard the stories about some radio systems being 15 and sometimes even late teens years old, and their folks, in order to keep them running, have to go on eBay and bid and win these bids and get systems and radios and so forth sent to them from sometimes internationally, just to keep their systems going. So they're doing a yeoman's job of doing that. So for interoperability specifically, we do have a lot of targets of what we do. We are updating. We're annually supposed to update our state communications interoperability plan, and it follows the national plan, which isn't surprising since that's where the funding comes from. We've added a couple of planks. So there's a plank on governance. There's a plank on standard operating procedures, which we try to do, which again facilitates interoperability among systems. There's one on technology, and surprisingly that is actually of, I won't say it's less important. It seems to have less focus right now, and people are really focused on training and SOPs and, of course, the funding and sustainability, which is one thing we've added to our plan that others don't have. We have a whole other plank on outreach and information sharing that's really related to, again, just keeping everybody talking so that when, say, jurisdiction A needs to make an investment in their radio system, that it doesn't preclude something from a neighboring radio system, that we're all aware of the impacts that we make on one another. Another one is usage. And then there's training and exercises. And so we work closely with not only OSP, but the partners who aren't here is Office of Emergency Management. They also have funding from Department of Homeland Security, and I sit on their grant panels, and they sit on our grant panels, and so we're working closely together. They just had a project, an annual funding cycle with Homeland Security Interoperability Funds. They had about 33 applicants for communications dollars, asking for around $4.5 or $5 million. They were only able to award a little over $900,000. that's kind of the environment we're in. We ran into that last spring and fall with some extra funds that we had. When I say we, really, it was ODOT and the radio project working with the SIEC. And so we ran an interoperability grant program through that. At one time, we had, I believe, 14 grant applications, also for about $4.5 million, and we were only able to fund, I believe, four of them at around $1.5 or $6 million. So the good news, bad news, is these grant programs identify a lot of need. It just kind of pulls our heartstrings. We're not able to fund everything that we know is needed by our first responders in the field. So other things that we're doing is last year, again with ODOT, we had the first annual what we call radio project. A lot of the work that we've done so far has been with, say, agency heads, bureau heads, the policymaker side, and that's been very effective. What we did last year for the first time was we had a conference just for the technology people and the operators, and we were expecting about 40 people to attend, and we had about 80. So with that level of demand, we're going to have another one and this fall, hopefully in October. And so that was very successful, and hope to have another one. And we'll have to keep an eye on, of course, the facility, because we expect to have even more people this time given the success of the first one. And that does include also folks from across state boundaries, because our systems do interoperate across the state boundaries as well. We have another project that we like to do about every other year, and I brought one of these manuals with me. This is both downloadable, and you can pull it off the web. It is an interoperability field guide. So when first responders cross these sort of physical but or imaginary but real boundaries of where the radios operate and don't operate, they can use this guide. It divides Oregon into six regions, and it sort of tells you who's on which frequencies. So as the first responders move, which they all do, they can stay in communication with the other first responders coming to or going from a scene. So this is something that also...
Yes.
I'm sorry. I may. Thank you very much. I apologize for interrupting you.
Please.
I just want to clarify something you're saying to me. So in an era when everything is changing every 27 seconds and we're using technology and most of our emergency responders have some kind of electronic equipment, communication equipment with them, we're using a paper spiral-bound book to tell them how to communicate with each other? I'm not trying to sound too skeptical or snarky. That's not my intention. I'm just a little puzzled.
We have this downloadable as well, and the link is on our website. And so we encourage the first responders to download it as they can.
But it's a PDF that... Downloadable.
There's both. We have a PDF there, and as well as downloadable as a mobile app.
Oh, it's an app.
And the paper copy.
If it's an app, then I'm all reassured.
Okay.
Because I see that, and I think there is no way on God's green earth I'd want to be driving down a road and searching through that as an emergency responder. But if I could, you know, have somebody look it up on an app, then while we're traveling, then I feel a little less worse.
Agreed. You'd be surprised how many requests we still get for the hard paper copy, sometimes because
You're out of range. True. Point well taken.
Or like here, it's a demonstration item.
But. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So some other things that we're doing on the voice interoperability front would be we're working with counties. For example, City of Eugene and Lane County recently contacted us because they have all these the facilities down in Eugene and the events they have, not just for the University of Oregon, but they've got like Olympic trials coming up and so forth. And so we're working with them, or they're working with us. We're working together to continue to develop and keep the plans current. So when Donald Trump went to Eugene, so for example, they have a whole interoperability plan. They know who's who and who's on first and which frequencies are for medical, fire, and so forth. And they update that every major event. So they'll be updating it again here with the trials coming up. And we've been talking to them more, and we've pulled in the federal government because the World Games will be coming to Eugene in 2021. So, again, depending on the situation, we're a little nimble. In this case, we will need to pull in the Department of Homeland Security because of the federal security potential impact of having the World Games in Eugene. So again, like I mentioned before, we are working closely with the Office of Emergency Management on these same items. We also work with Homeland Security. They provide us free requests for technical assistance, and we typically get 5 per year. And so what, rather than being just opportunistic, we're working with the Interoperability Executive Council to sort of be a little more strategic in what we request and say pick 3 or 4, but leave 1 as sort of opportunistic through the year. And one of those that we're doing is we're doing an inventory of the use of federal frequencies in the valley, and that's a process that's ongoing. We've talked to them about integrating some of that work with the statewide inventory that I discussed, and so we're working with them to kind of break it down so they can do their piece and we can do ours. Those are things we've done. They've done countywide assessments. That's really good. The bad news is they often look very, very similar to one another, and they come back and identify a lot of the gaps, and the gaps tend to be exist primarily due to lack of funding, which I know is no surprise. Again, we have the size and scope of the state radio project, and as you may have seen, Washington County, Clackamas County recently passed $60 and $80 million bond measures, and that's just for those county systems. So you can magnify that down the valley and across the state, and the funding and sustainability is a pretty big question, and that we're trying to help on, but it's difficult. So that kind of is, in a nutshell, some of the work we're doing with voice. The SIEC is also the governance body over FirstNet. FirstNet is a federal radio project. It is a wireless data system that is being designed and built as we speak. It will be many, many billions of dollars. The RFP for that is a nationwide RFP. It was released in January. That closes at the end of May. We're hearing that 2 or 3 companies at least have bid on it. At a state level, what we do is we provide data about the state, our first responders, our radio systems, the usage, et cetera, up to FirstNet, which is Department of Commerce, to help them design the best plan that they can. For Oregon, we will not have legal standing in the contract that FirstNet has with the vendor, so we need to give FirstNet every piece of information that we can so that the state plan that they contract for with the vendor for Oregon is the best that we can get. Primarily in Oregon, it comes down to initially a coverage issue because of the expense. Oregon, like many Western states, is a little over 50% in federal ownership. So the FirstNet identified what they called coverage objectives, and looking at that map, it was going to cover about 25% of Oregon. And so we worked diligently for 6 to 9 months on collecting other data sets and sending those back to the federal government, and our data sets demonstrate that we would like to have fixed coverage over roughly 75% of Oregon with mobile coverage over the other 25. So we can just keep working on that. We won't really know exactly what the plan is until the contract is done. But in the meantime, what happens right now is we're working with FirstNet. And again, when I say we, it's the State Interoperability Executive Council. And we are staffing some of their technical and operational committees, one primarily on what's called quality of service priority and preemption. As FirstNet will provide spectrum that when first responders need it, unlike today, we can flip a switch and it will bump the commercial traffic off. So it'll be dedicated public safety spectrum just for first responders. But again, this is primarily for data. They probably can do voice over it, but it won't be mission critical voice like the state radio project and the radio systems that our first responders have for probably a half a generation at least. And I mean, 10 years is sort of my minimum, what I'm hearing. I'm thinking more like 15 or maybe even 20. So FirstNet is not a replacement for the what we call LMR. It is not a replacement for mission-critical voice. And it's not at this point designed to be. It's a data system for all the first responders that sort of leaping interoperability forward in the data sphere will have, because everyone will be able to see the data flow. And how that exactly gets managed, again, we don't really know. FirstNet put out an objectives-based RFP, not a requirements-based RFP. So it said, here's these 16 primary things that we would like you to do. Show us how you do it, to use the innovation of the private sector. So the good news is it really turns the private sector loose. The bad news is we don't really have anything to evaluate, really quite know what we're going to get just yet. But we're very hopeful and excited and looking for greater coverage in Oregon. We were also working diligently with the tribes in rural Oregon as well on that system. We need it to not be a sort of the typical have and have not. We're trying to bridge that divide as much as we can with the FirstNet system that will be coming through. So again, that the RFP closes at the end of May. FirstNet hopes to have an award and a contract signed with the vendor by November, which is Godspeed. And then they will work for about 6 months and provide every state a state plan. They'll release that on the same day for all states. They'll do it through a portal. And at that point, we'll have probably 30 days, maybe 60, and on the draft to get any information back to them that we would like to see changed. And then there will be a formal 90-day process where they present the plan to the state of Oregon and all states, where the governors then either say, okay, FirstNet will build and operate and maintain and manage that system, or the state itself will. It's called opting out. There's no revenue benefit for the governor to opt out. Not sure why that's there in the law, but that's the process. The revenues to support that would be somewhere between unknown to worse. They would be subscriber revenues, spectrum lease revenues, and whatever pot the federal government had $7 billion initially to build it. They spent $500 million on research. They've got a research facility in Boulder next to the University of Colorado. And the other 6.5 is then going to be spread among to the vendor to build out the states. So the primary revenues to build FirstNet is going to be the spectrum lease revenues when the first responders don't need this spectrum, and then also the subscriber revenues. So I'm not sure, I don't have much more on FirstNet right now, because like I said, the RFP closes, as like with our state processes, when there's an open RFP, they can't talk about it. So we don't really know. We don't know who the responders are. But that's the target. So the governor will have a plan probably in the early summer of next year, have 90 days, have made the plan, and then FirstNet moves into construction and development across the country. And we will know more what our involvement will be at that time.
Questions? So I was the first representative assigned to SEIC, and so I've been watching this for a while, I had high hopes for Owen, as many of us did, and it just became too expensive and had many setbacks and problems, and we had to narrow our scope. And ODOT's done a great job in picking up the pieces and fulfilling the pieces that we narrowed that scope to. But I think we've got a lot to do. And you described FirstNet, which is a data system, but we don't even have complete interoperability in our voice system. One step is to connect all the trunk systems that exist in the state. Is there any prognosis, and if and when that will be done?
The short answer is not that I know of. Again, that will be reflected hopefully in the study findings that I mentioned earlier about the P25 trunk systems. Mm-hmm. And we hope to have that study started soon and a product delivered next spring. And we'll know much better then about what it will take to have the P25 system, trunk systems, interoperate, both technically and operationally, but also financially.
So that's just that report will be ready for this committee sometime during the next session. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that would be honestly a little aggressive. Oh no, it's February to June next.
Correct.
That's our target.
Okay.
That's our target.
I'm looking forward to that. Any final questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What are we doing next?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, I think we can close this informational hearing and move on to an informational meeting on the state data security and overview of that.
Okay. So I will close this informational hearing, and I'll open an informational hearing on state data security and our first panel, state CIO and the state CIOS, however you say that.
Yes.
The security person.
So, Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Richards, and I'm the Chief Information Security Officer, or CISO, for the state of Oregon, working for Alex Pettit, our state CIO. And what I was, as I understood from what your goals were today in this informational session, was to understand a bit about how we're dealing with information security in the state, how we're assessing sort of at the state level, how are we doing, and then a particular focus on what have we done from, I recognize most of you from Jay Clement when we talked about the SOS Secretary of State audit of the data center, what have we done since that audit? And so I've got a lot of color on that. And I'll talk about a few of the challenges, sort of systematic challenges that I think it's good for the committee to be aware of. And then I wanted to end on a real positive note of something we're real excited about, and just wanted to share it, that I think it's a real positive direction for security for the state of Oregon. So with that, first of all, just a little bit of history. I came to the state as the state CISO in September of 2014, and my first experience of the state was October of 2014, being at Employment Division. It was one of the biggest breaches we've seen in the state of Oregon, information security breaches in the state of Oregon. Immediately following that, I had a little respite for holidays, and then the data center. I got moved to the data center in early 2015. And quickly, my group, which when I came in was originally structured to be mostly a policy group, became a quite a bit larger operational security group. And so what you're going to hear is the evolution of that over the last year or so. So with that, as a little bit of background, the Enterprise Security Office is created by statute under the state CIO after House Bill 3099 passed. And our main function is to lay out an enterprise security plan, the policies and guidelines and standards that the state is supposed to follow, every agency, short of those with independent authority, so short of the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, Legislature, the AG's office, and the Judicial Department. So we lay out sort of the plan and give all the tools to agencies, and then we're supposed to monitor agencies to make sure that they're meeting those requirements. One of the challenges of that statute is, pardon me, in the same statute, agency directors are assigned specifically the responsibility to execute on security, and they are also assigned all of the budget and everything else. So the actual means to execute security at the agency level lives at the agency level, which makes things kind of challenging. You lay out a policy, and then folks kind of make budget decisions that might change how that gets executed. We have a few other centralized functions. We're sort of the state 911 for security incidents. So when an agency incident gets bigger or involves multiple agencies, like Employment Department happened in October of 2014, we move in, and I have a team of folks that do that, as well as they have specialized skills that we can't really afford to invest in, at each agency, specialized forensic skills and some other specialized security skills. As I mentioned in February, by executive order, Alex was assigned the data center, and very quickly I was assigned security for the data center. And this is where my operational world came onto my plate, and quite a bit changed what I've spent my time doing. So with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about that later, but I want to talk about assessing state security. And actually, there's two parts, right? First is laying out the plan. And the plan that we're currently executing on was written in 2009. We were in the process of writing another one, and I think I mentioned that at Jay Clement, for those that were at Jay Clement. And it's a little bit late, but part of the reason it's a little bit late is I'm really trying to make it a thoughtful rather than just a revision, but actually a full sort of different model that will provide a better direction for the state. And so we're looking at the standards and looking at, we've based on an international standard, and there's questions as to whether that's the right direction. We've already started reworking all of the sort of down at the technical level, the guidelines have already been started to work as a cross-agency group, is already working on that, and that's going to be actually published this summer. And we've just kicked off this quarter reworking policy. Unfortunately, policy really should trail the plan, because the plan will inform policy. I think there will be policies that will go away and others that will need to be drafted. So the other half of this is the assessment part, and that's where I want to spend most of the time, because it really gives you the picture of what's going on in the state. So the three big ways that we assess security at the state level, not at the agency level, sort of across the whole state, is first, we our partners, the state auditor. So the Secretary of State does periodic audits of parts of the organization. They've before I came on, they audited the Enterprise Security Office. Since I've been on, they've audited the State Data Center, and they're now in the process of auditing state agencies, so multiple agencies, to kind of look holistically at how security is working at the agency level. We also, as part of our mandate, funded from our office, we run an annual risk assessment called the Information Security Business Risk Assessment. I'm going to talk about it in a little bit more detail, so I'm going to just leave that the details off. And then we rely on agencies to do assessments. As I mentioned, the budget and the execution is left at the agency level, and so there's a need that they are also executing within their budget in order to cover the next layer down, the deeper detailed layer. So some of the state-level assessments, so this is not covering the agency assessments. I'll talk about those in a little bit later. The agency-level assessments have happened since I've been on staff. We've had two ISPRA assessments. We have had the Secretary of State State Data Center audit, which I'm going to talk about some, at least what we did about it in detail. I'm going to let the details of the audit, I'm going to leave that to Neil Witherspoon, who I believe will be up immediately following me. And then we also, the Secretary of State, as I mentioned, has kicked off this statewide agency audit, which we expect to see some results later this year. So first one I wanted to talk about is ISPRA, and there's a little bit of context here because I'm going to show you a trend here of what we're doing in the state. So I apologize for the background, but this is something that we commission outside. It's done by KPMG. It's been done for 8 years, so we got a track record of a history that we can see a trend line. There's a set of baseline agencies, sort of a dozen representative agencies of different sizes to try and give a cross section, and we try to keep those the same across so that our numbers have a certain amount of fidelity in them, but then we also try to include new agencies each year and sort of rotate people through so that everyone is exposed. One of the values of the business risk assessment is actually awareness to the business leaders and agencies of the things that really need to be implemented. And by putting the audit in front of them, it helps to get that awareness and get movement. So we do about a dozen agencies a year, give or take, and what they do is they start with KPMG's proprietary survey. So they start with asking, sending an email. Here's a bunch of questions to answer. You fill out a large document, and then they come in and they do interviews, and they look at documents. But they do not review operations. They don't sit next to somebody, watch them do operations. They don't scan systems. So the business part, literally, that it stays up at the process level. And they give us a maturity against ISO 27000 is the current state plans framework that we've picked. It's an international standard for managing security. They audit us for maturity against that at each agency. And so CMMI is kind of a well-known maturity model. It's used for lots of different things. Just as a quick summary of what it is, it's got five levels. And without reading what's on the slide, it starts at sort of an ad hoc level. You're doing something, but it's not really documented. It's not really well repeated or consistent. The next level is, okay, you've got sort of a process that's consistent, but maybe you've written some of it down, but it's not done consistently at defined level. Now you've written it down, and you're doing it on a pretty regular basis. And then the next level logically is now that you're doing it consistently, you can measure it. And then once you can measure it, you can optimize it, which is the sort of nirvana of maturity. Most projects that use CMMI don't actually strive to get all the way to the top. Part of the reason is because it's expensive to get all the way to the top. And usually a maturity model of somewhere around 4 is a really good place to be because you now can measure it, which means you can manage it. Certainly you don't want to be down in the 1s and 2s. So where we are as a state, over 8 years of doing the ISPRA, and this is the reason for the background, was to show you where we've gone as a state. So these numbers, remember, you know, different agencies are graded each year because we're mixing agencies in and out. And there's a little bit of voodoo math here because we actually the standards changed in the middle. But this is a fairly normalized line of a trend that shows us basically went from just short of 2 to just over 3, which means we're at the sort of defined stage. We have written policies. People are following them, at least as it looks in a paper analysis. One of the concerns as I look at this chart, and it looks good. It looks like we've got a positive trend, right? Rise. We had rise on the slope. That's good. The problem I have is it took 8 years to get from 2 to 3, which means if we stay on the current trend, it'll take us another 8 years to get anywhere near something that we can measure, which means we can actually manage it. The other concern I have is, as I mentioned, it's a paper analysis. And what I've seen over and over in incidents and what I've seen, even they've seen in their audit, and I'll see on the next slide, is that we're not getting down necessarily to the controls level where the actual risks occur, where the system vulnerabilities are, where those things that get breached happen. So it looks really good on paper, but if you actually sat and watched what people did, or you looked at where the investments happened, they're not happening. And if you look at this chart, just quick visually, you know, when I learned about stoplights in traffic class, yellow's bad, right? Yellow means slow down, you're about to get in a wreck, not, you know, you're doing fine. And almost everything on that chart is in the yellow or the red. I argue they've been conservative here and more should be in the red. The only green's physical, which means we lock our doors. That's not really an IT security thing. It's related, but it's a little bit disappointing. And if you look at how much is up and to the right, like things that are very possible or could have a moderate or better effect, that's most of the things on that chart. And that's based on their assessment. I think this is conservative. I'd be more aggressive and say we're carrying more risk. And so what we're looking at with this assessment, and I've been challenging the team, I've only done 1 year of running with it, is to get another kind of assessment and get down into more of the details. The problem is how to scale that to every agency. And I'm going to talk about what it looks like, because the data center is effectively what we did at the data center, but I'm just not sure how we scale that to every agency in the state. So I'm not going to steal Neil's thunder to talk about this state data center audit, other than these were the high-level bullets of what was in the audit report. The one thing I will say is the report was effectively a gap analysis, not an actual risk assessment. So what we got was, if you took a standard framework and you said a secure data center should have these things, here are the things we didn't have, basically, or the things that we weren't doing well enough to be meeting what would be considered reasonable care. Now, the problem is that it's not prioritized because there's no risk ratings on any of it. So there's just, it's all the same risk level. So the first thing that I did with this is to actually have a second assessment done from a risk perspective. And we had Microsoft come in and go through, and this kind of assessment, different than an ISPRA kind of assessment, we're only asking questions. They actually looked over the shoulder of techs. They said, go log into the system and show me what your policy, the configuration of the systems look like. So they actually got into the details. And what I got out of that was very actionable vulnerabilities or issues to work at the state data center, as well as some priority from what we saw at the Secretary of State audit. So the great thing is that they were very consistent. So now I have 2 sources, and we ain't even had 3rd sources because we had a few coincidentally penetration tests going on from agencies that included the data center. And what a penetration test looks like is, hey, let's try to attack the thing. Let's try to break it just like the bad guys would do. And they found and exploited the same kind of areas when they did the tests. So we now have, you know, 3 sources and very good data to rank risk. And so that's what we used this for. And from that,
We then drove the steps that we've taken out at the data center. And as I said, I think this is kind of the model for how we might fix security at each agency, and unfortunately, it's very expensive. So some of the big steps. The first thing was moving operational security folks over to my shop. So if you looked at the state data center, there were folks doing security as part of their job. There was no leadership and there was no development going on. So the folks would kind of do what they did yesterday and not be keeping up the tools up. So the first thing I did was grab folks that either were doing part-time security or I thought had aptitude for security and brought them into one team. So I added them. We went to five times our size and then turned around and started to train them. And so we've now completed well over an average of about 40 hours specialized training per person in the team, and I don't think we're done. Part of the problem was just general security knowledge was just not in place. And so that was one of the first things, was to get the team ready to go. And this doesn't even count the soft skill things that security practitioners need that we've also trained on, like communications and influencing and things that we need to do. We're trying to get agencies to do things, and we're doing it at an arm's distance. I mentioned the independent risk assessment. The only thing I'd add to it is we've moved, by partnership with the data center, we've moved to an annual cadence with this. And we also ran a joint simulation with the state data center and the security office with the federal government, and we're using that to key off doing all, not just a risk assessment, but also doing simulations of breaches. It's a live test, and so that's something that we're both of those are moving to an annual scale, annual cadence. One of the biggest things that I did with those 20 folks is I took about five of them and put them in to build up what we're calling Oregon Security Operations Center. So previously at the data center, there was one person full-time that monitored security, and then everyone else kind of maybe helped him when they had time. We now have a dedicated team that does this, and we combined it with the functions that we already had from statute for managing, being the centralized place for escalation of security incidents. What that team also does is it's a point of coordination as we get threatened information from federal partners. So when the Department of Homeland Security or the FBI calls us up and has information for us, or when we get a feed from an information sharing group that we're in for security, we have one place to bring it in, collate it, and disseminate it. And it's something that that team actually does for the whole state. So it's not just state government. We get stuff for local, tribal, county, and schools. And so some of the stuff we're routing, it's even going outside of state government. So that team is kind of, I would say, in phase one. We've got the people, we've got them trained, and we're actually working with vendors to figure out exactly what should this thing look like as we build it up. The first goal is to get the data center part of this, so the state networks, and then we want to grow it to actually help it be of greater value to agencies. This one at the bottom actually didn't come up in any of the risk assessments, but I wanted to point it out that I just got the results of this recently, but we actually commissioned security analysis on the mainframe. And the reason why I bring up the mainframe is, you know, usually risk assessments in modern systems, people don't want to look at the mainframe because mainframes are old and I don't understand them. And so we actually had to go and do a totally separate with specialized resources assessment because it fell off all the other risk assessments. And so we brought in those specialized resources and we at least have the report of a list to go put through this risk management process and figure out what are we going to start working on. And then we will probably engage that resource to help us with addressing those issues. The mainframe, why did I pick the mainframe? All the good stuff's in the mainframe. So DOR puts all our tax records in the mainframe, our HR records, our payroll records, the Medicare data, it's all in the mainframe. So we don't secure the mainframe, we've got a pretty serious problem. Some additional steps that we took. We worked on some of the critical policies that were missing at the state data center. So the state data center had inherited a lot of policies and procedures from DAS. And when you run a data center, it doesn't look quite the same as what everybody else in DAS would use. And so we had to add things like, and you have incident response, and you have customers, and you have their systems. You need a different kind of plan than you would have just at your agency. And so we put in place both plans and policies for security incident response. We've just recently put in risk management processes so that they actually have a way to make good decisions about risk, security risk in the state data center. We worked on privileged access, and probably the crown jewel of where the data center, and the data center really took this and ran with it. This wasn't my team other than to be the catalyst, is patch management. What they did was, most of our environments Microsoft-based, they were patching on a quarterly basis, but the patches were very inconsistently applied. And so what you would see is they sort of do a best effort, but a lot of the systems will go unpatched. Well, this is one of the best ways the systems get attacked. One of the best ways into the state is, you know, I'm browsing the web on an unpatched system, and now I'm in the network. What they did is they brought in all agency folks, they brought in security folks and operational folks, which is important because if you just bring in the security folks, they'll have one opinion that won't make sense operationally and vice versa. And they brought in multiple agencies, they brought in Microsoft, and they worked this thing out. Now we're doing monthly patching, and we're, instead of just taking blindly patches from Microsoft, we're actually have a review process to look at the severity of those patches, because some of them are, Microsoft might say they're not that bad, but we do need to look at them, and we actually should apply them because into our environment they are a big risk. So it's like one of the greatest things that's operationally happened out there. We added security assessments to all change management. So whenever there's a major change at the data center, there's a change management process. There now has to be a written impact assessment to the security of the data center that's actually written by my team. You know, some kind of treatment, few sentences, what's the risk? And that goes into the risk decisions as to whether the change is approved. And everybody sees that the change process is kind of all customers are part of that process. So that means many eyes on the risk rather than just one or two. We made one of the biggest ones. We're making a deeper investment in looking at the data center security. And this is not, the data center architecture. And this is not just security, but it's affecting how fast we can move. The data center security or architecture, I think, was built by evolution. It started with lift and drop of different agencies, bring them all into the data center, but we didn't really change them. And so what you see is every agency looks a little bit different. The layout looks a little bit different, and the boundary between what is the data center's responsibility and what's the agency's responsibility is a little bit different. And when Microsoft came and did the risk assessment, they saw this jagged line of it's not really clear whose job it is every time. You have to look, and you have to go to the right person and ask the right question. The same problem I see in operationally. We make network changes, and they take days rather than hours because they're too complicated. You have to go to a few people that actually know all the tribal knowledge to figure out how the network works. The worst one was when we went to monitor for security, and we do our security monitoring to instrument it, because of the complexity of the network and the way the flows work, we were having to build infrastructure that was larger than anything deployed anywhere in the United States. I mean, think of your biggest data center. We were orders of magnitude bigger than that if we actually wanted to monitor the way we needed to monitor, which definitely pointed to some architectural challenges. And so we're now working in partnership with the data center to figure out what's the right architecture and how are we going to get to a simpler architecture. One of the biggest points I'd put there is if an architecture is that complicated and that hard to manage, you can't secure it because security and complexity are diametrically opposed. And so it's a symptom that we have a lot of work to do. Other things, we did some targeted projects. I've listed a couple here, but these had to do with basically knocking off the top things that made that risk list. Once we did our risk assessment and we actually graded everything, we picked the top three. Unfortunately, every one of these, because of the way the data center works, it affects many agencies. These are all multi-month projects, maybe even might take as long as a year. Like if I want to change how credential management works, I'm changing the credentials that everybody uses, so it affects business across the board. So these are very difficult where they have business aspects as well as technical aspects. One of the biggest ones we're doing right now actually is scanning the perimeter, so going from outside the state in and looking at what does it look like from an attacker? Just look across our whole front line. What does it look like? And trying to find the systems that are most vulnerable and get them either offline or get them fixed. We also prioritized infrastructure replacement. There's a lot of old security gear and some old operating systems. This came up in the Secretary of State audit. And what we've done is prioritized the riskiest. We've done this prioritized by risk. You're just kind of hearing a theme about risk. But rather than worrying about which gear we took offline and did we get five routers offline this year, we looked at how much risk did we take off the board? How many risky agencies did I take off risky equipment? And so we actually prioritized based on what's the data and what's the risk to the state if that system goes down and we lose capabilities. And then finally, I'm proudest of in my shop of having now a statewide risk register and actually doing statewide risk management. And that's what informed a lot of this. We started with the data center risks, and now we're adding to that with all the other risks as we find them. So that gives me a way to prioritize my whole team's efforts to the things that are going to give us the biggest return for the state. So I said I'd talk about agency assessments. So this is the list of every one of the agency assessments that I'm aware of since I've been on staff. So one of the challenges is you probably notice there's a lot of folks missing, and a good deal of those we actually ran ourselves, and we didn't have the bandwidth to run anymore. So I'm really worried that though we have this state scan that's kind of on paper, we're not getting those deep scans like what we did with the data center, where we were able to dig through the details and actually start knocking out the details that really have to get done. Doesn't mean the risk assessments aren't getting done, but there's a real problem with them getting to our office and awareness. So some of the challenges, and that kind of leads into this last part, I think my feeling is, even though you saw that nice pretty chart where we've gone to a 2 to a 3 in maturity and everything looks great, my feeling is we're falling behind in the race, and it's because when you get down to those details, if I actually could do those assessments at every agency, we would find a lot uglier picture. And the landscape of security threats is growing very fast, but we're not growing very fast as an organization. As I saw when I grabbed folks from the data center and started training them, I saw, okay, that we're starting from the beginning here in growing you, not we're starting from intermediate and we're building experts. And that's very troubling. The other thing is this federated model that we have, where we have shared responsibility that the state CIO's office needs to direct policy and they make sure people are doing everything that they're supposed to, but then the actual execution lives at the agency and the budget lives at the agency, is it just leads to a lot of finger pointing in both directions. And my guess is when we hear results of the state audit at agency level from Secretary of State, we'll hear a lot of that. Well, ESO's not giving us enough direction. The agencies will say we don't have enough budget. And there's a lot of finger-pointing going on because nobody's really in charge. And there's also a ton of duplication of effort. So we've got, you know, every kind of virus scanner out there. We've got every kind of firewall out there. And therefore, we're not building up a base of skills in the state, but rather we have this diverse, sort of dispersed workforce that's not easily movable within the state. If we were to stay in a completely federated model, if you ignore the 20 folks that came over to do the operational challenges I had, 5 people is not enough to cover the hundreds of agencies with the way that things are being conducted. And the reason I think that the agency, we have this problem or this challenge is not really that the agencies have the wrong, they're doing the wrong thing. It's just that they're focused on services they should be. You know, I take health authority, right? They healthy people, that's what they're all about. Not healthy people and let's secure information, right? It's about healthy people. And so when it comes down to secure information or healthy people wins. And, you know, Alex brought up a great analogy that I think really hammers it home when you look at the airport. If we gave Southwest, Delta, and Alaska and said, forget the TSA, you guys do security, you know, there would be no security line at the airport. Why? Because it gets in the way of me having tickets. Whoever has the longest line, that's the guy who's not getting any money, right? Unless planes were getting knocked down every day by terrorists and it actually was a buying criteria to get on the most secure plane, you'd go to the one with the shortest line. So the TSA, and that's the reason why the TSA is almost universally loved when it comes to actually passing the legislation. Everybody hates the process, but every time it comes around to pass the law or fund it, they do it. Why? Because it won't get done if we don't fund it. And I think that sort of really kind of puts the color on the fact that I think agencies are doing what they're supposed to do and focusing on service, but it's diametrically opposed to getting the proper allocation to security. The last thing is that I just want to mention is the competition for staff and resources. So I've just talked about the competition for resources where we're a little bit opposed to the agency directions. But also when we talk about staff, The pay scales for information systems, the highest pay scale at the highest step is not enough to get me even an intermediate security professional out from to attract them from another state. We don't have a big technology base that I can attract them in the state. So we effectively end up having to build them up. And then when they leave and go to private sector, we have a hole. And the way that hole gets filled is we play musical chairs inside of the state. So when I came on, within a month, one of my folks got a job at the, in private sector. That job got filled by the information security officer from the state police. Then the state police had to fill their information security officer, and I believe they got another state person. And you see this round robin, and it disrupts every single one of the agencies when they lose their leadership or key security folks. And so it's another thing where I think we probably need to raise, move up a level on how we look at staffing security across the state, because as long as we're doing that, we're basically stealing from each other. And it's actually kind of an inside joke among all the security folks in the state that, oh, you got a job. Okay. Somebody filled it. Okay. Who did you steal from? So, so with that, I don't just want to talk about problems, and I'm hoping Alex is going to help me with the exciting part of this, which is we're exploring some new models, and this is a little bit of a right turn, but I really wanted to share this with the committee. We're looking at security kind of widely. So, you know, I talk about a lot of the tactical problems, but looking at security across the whole state of Oregon, security is fundamentally kind of a community problem. I mean, current security models is you build a castle with really tall walls and really, really deep moats. But that's a horrible model if you're trying to do commerce. The reason it worked in castles is you go out once a day and you come in once a day and nobody visits, right? Now, when you think about today's connected environment or the state that it fundamentally has to provide services to the public, you need a different model. And you're fundamentally connected, which means if I'm connected to somebody that's insecure, they actually bring me down. I think of, you know, my buddy comes in, he wants to put his computer on my Wi-Fi at home. If his system is infected, he puts it on my Wi-Fi. Now all my systems are infected. And what happens when things go badly is we see a lot of blame and shame and blame, which is kind of, you think of like, hey, if you get a certain disease and somebody doesn't really want to talk about it because it's shameful, well, it's the same thing when you get a virus. Hey, what bad website did you go to? What were you doing on your computer you shouldn't have been doing? When the fact of the matter is you don't have to do anything bad anymore. And one of the most recent breaches that was infecting computers was a banner ad that infected folks, and it was on Forbes.com. And I bet probably a good number of folks in this room have been on Forbes.com in the last 6 months. I know I have. And so we all could have, anybody that had been to Forbes.com could have potentially been impacted. So it's really the wrong model.
Sorry, can I just clarify about
that? Yes, ma'am.
Do you have to actually click on the ad or just actually view it? I'm curious because it's one of those things I keep trying to learn all the things I shouldn't do.
Yeah, Chair Riley, Senator Hayward, Snyder Hayward, you don't actually have to click on it. What happens is that the ad itself is active content, and it will execute active engines in your browser. So when the content starts playing, like you see a little video or something jumping around, it's actually executing code inside the browser, and it can take advantage of the browser code and a vulnerability in that browser code to actually infect your machine. So that's actually, go to the site.
So, fabulous. The things I learned.
Disable Flash. Flash in that particular case.
So the answer is don't turn on your computer.
And use Macs and not PCs because they're
disable
less
Flash.
For the moment.
Pop-up blockers, lots of other things.
Really?
But
pop-up blockers I do anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, what we looked at this, we said this is fundamentally a community problem, and we need to help the people that have the least resources to deal with these things and deal with it as a community rather than dealing with it as my organization with my walls and my moat. And so we pitched to the National Governors Association a concept of this community-based model of something that we try to apply in the state of Oregon using public health as a model. Go and study public health, look at how they've dealt with communicable diseases, how they deal with, like, you know, community health clinics and helping the folks that most need health care, and see where we can apply that. And so we're actually next week going to Detroit to work this. And I don't know, boss, if you wanted to add anything to this, because I know you're real excited about it too. So
I am. Chairman Riley, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the state of Oregon. So the model that we had adopted. So IT is a discipline of borrowing. We're a very young discipline, and practice for us still leads research, unlike in medicine where you wouldn't you'd be disbarred if you were practicing and then and not focusing on the research. That's really how we do things in IT. We're still a very very new discipline, and we try things all the time to see if it works or not. So we borrow a lot of models from other disciplines, more mature disciplines. And in this case, what we've proposed is to adopt a model from public health, and specifically with how to deal with epidemics and look at different models for addressing epidemics and viruses, outbreaks, and things like that. So many of the organizations that we interoperate or need to share information with, school districts, local municipalities, counties, are in and of themselves have a very weak security profile. And as a consequence, as Stefan had said, that then in turn jeopardizes the state's profile. And that's something that, rather than blame and shame them, rather than look to them as being the culprit and find out who their CISO was so that we know not to hire that person, we're proposing a different model, which is to bring them to a place, perhaps offer them resources, offer them help, offer them the opportunity to get their problems addressed. If you're familiar with the book Outliers by Malcolm
Gladwell.
He writes of that time Mayor O'Malley's attempt to address the sexually transmitted disease outbreak epidemic in Baltimore in the 1990s, opening free clinics, not asking people for identification, not going through and asking for the listing of everybody they've come into contact with, just to treat the problem that's brought to them, and first of all diagnose it, treat it, do a prescription, treat it, and then evaluate what you're doing and continue that cycle of treatment, of prescription and treatment. So that's essentially what we're adopting here. We're proposing to adopt here. The hope is that, or I guess our expectation is it has received interest from the National Governors Association. We are developing. We've reached out to some partners here. Intel has shown an interest.
Microsoft
HP. Has shown an interest. Hewlett Packard shown an interest. Our prayer is that we can have something for the state of Oregon to consider in the 2017 session as well, to really try to make a difference in something that seems to be a circling the drain type activity right now. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may, I wish you luck. If your experience is anything like mine with immunizations, good luck.
Thank you.
You would think that people would understand that things like preventing polio is kind of a community obligation.
You would hope.
But you would be wrong.
Chairman Riley, Senator Hayward, thank you for the observation.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pettit. I'm just feeling frustrated by these people sometimes.
And that is fundamentally what you bring up is fundamentally one of the challenges that I believe that you will hear from the Secretary of State and others is in a community-type model, a federated model, we do rely very much upon the voluntary engagement of the various folks and their prioritization of it. And unfortunately, when we do live in a community where the weakness of one of us is really a weakness to all of us, it's becoming something that we have to change the paradigm that we're approaching this with. Truly, we feel that it should at least be discussed at a policy level.
Could not agree with you more, sir.
Thank you. And I think Chairman Riley and members of the committee, that's the end of the testimony I had prepared for today.
Other questions, comments?
That was very thorough.
Oh, thank you.
It was very thorough. Thank you very much. And, as Senator Steiner Hayward has said, good luck. We really look forward to seeing some success in partnering with all of the various people around and getting things squared away. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, sir.
So we're going to continue on, if you want to come up. I'm going to hear from the Secretary of State's office.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Neil Weatherspoon. I'm the IT audit manager at the Secretary of State. Been there for coming on a little more than 20 years now, and I'd hope that right now would be a time to applaud, because what we've just heard from our CIO and CISO is more movement on security than I've seen in the prior 20 years, you know, literally. I sat down next to Stefan, you know, prior to our meeting today, and said that by the time you get done with your presentation, I should just say amen, and we could all go home.
That's a good idea.
It is, you know, I do applaud that. However, David, you've asked me today to share a little bit about a report that we issued in 2015, and I think the title to the report kind of says it all, and that's that State Data Center: First Steps to Address Longstanding Security Risks. Much more to do. That's exactly where we're at. We've seen, you know, the first steps taken, and if we continue along the path, then much can be done from the standing of the State Data Center. Now, the State Data Center is really important to all agencies for various reasons. One is that many of the very critical computer programs and applications are there in-house, along with the very sensitive, confidential, important information that those applications process. And also, the State Data Center provides networking for agencies that some who don't even have applications at the data center. So it's the resource center, I guess, for computing within the state of Oregon. And because of the the centrality of that resource, it's a target, you know, from anyone who wants to walk the path into Department of Human Resources or into DAS or any of the other agencies. They would probably take their first steps through the state data center, through their networks. With that importance, we as a Secretary of State have noted for a long time the importance of the data center and what we could do to help the state improve, you know, our stance, you know, with security. So we audit every few years. We started, you know, prior to the data center when we had multiple data centers and we visited those. But once the data center was conceived, we went in and we've been back every couple of 3 years. Now, in that trek that we have taken from 2006, 2008, 2009, 2012, and then our latest audit in 2015, we've had some recurring angst as we've gone in. And the kinds of things that we've seen are components of security that either weren't there or weren't effectively accomplished. And, you know, so we're talking about due diligence. And I'd like to, you know, remind everyone that all security, you know, isn't, you know, completely dependent on the state data center. I'd like to make an analogy that the state data center is like a you know, effectively a fine restaurant. You know, you've got the infrastructure there in a fine restaurant that you would attend, and whether or not that fine restaurant actually gives you a good meal depends not only on the infrastructure at the fine restaurant, but the cook and the resources or you know, the raw materials that the cooks use. Okay, and so the data center is much just like the infrastructure of the restaurant. You can certainly have a good meal at a restaurant that recently hasn't passed inspection. But, you know, if you've got a good cook there and they use good materials and stuff like that, but you may not want to eat there. On the other hand, you can have the, you know, the cleanest, you know, restaurant, but if you got a bad cook, not good there either. And so there's this partnership between the state data center and agencies themselves who house their goods and their data in the data center. So, you know, our audits of the data center are looking at the infrastructure, the networking, the things that only the data center can effectively manage and affect, and things like the patching of the physical boxes and the maintenance of network infrastructure and all of those things that only the data center can handle because it's the centralized resource. And so some of the things that we found that were disconcerting were what I would call, you know, programmatic things, like being able to manage the people who have critical or monumental access, those god-like powers that folks who work at the data center have, and maybe some of those powers that have been distributed to members of the agencies themselves who are working out of there. And also, you know, that there's your responsibility. There's a lot going on with a network because that's your portal to the outside world where lots of nasty people live and would like to be in. And so working that network thing is very critical. It's the only you know, because the data center controls that portal to the internet and also helps and facilitates the interconnectability between agencies, you know, it's imperative that process of networking is nailed down, that you're have, you know, the physical controls that are there to block things, that you're effectively monitoring that traffic. And by the way, it's unbelievable how much traffic would go through the data center, and to pick out those things that are nasty or inappropriate or, you know, a potential vector for a breach is a monumental task. But there are tools, there are things that we could do as a state to at least lessen that risk, and we found many of those things were missing and had been for a long time. So it kind of gets me down to, well, how come we could go back year after year and see, you know, not you know, a lot of change, and matter of fact, really none. You know, we saw in the in our audits times when the data center would buy, you know, a physical device, you know, to help with security or to implement a security program, only to see it sit on the shelf because there was no one to run it, or to have it come, you know, not even effectively deployed before the device itself years later went obsolete. And so we saw that kind of stuff, and we thought, well, what really is the cause? And what is the, you know, the primary cause that we identified, you know, over and over again, was that no one was assigned to do it. Or, you know, no one was really responsible at the data center or at the state to ensure this important thing came to pass. That's why at the beginning of my presentation, I said, let's applaud, because for the first time, you know, as I sit here, I see someone responsible, someone in charge, and someone doing something about the things that we've been, you know, for so long, you know, imploring them to do, and other auditors from the federal government and others have said, hey, you know, you really need to get this act together. Well, now we see people there who are, you know, are responsible to get this done, and we see some movement, and that gives me, you know, an ounce of faith that thing will go forward. And but, you know, there's an auditor slogan that that I've always employed, and that's in God we trust, and all others will bring evidence. And, you know, that's what we're looking for now. We see, you know, the very foundation steps being taken, and we applaud that. And now it's time for, you know, progress and to move forward. And so those are the first steps, you know, that we saw, you know, since the audit. You know, the governor stepped in and did some movement of human resources to make sure there was someone in charge, and our CIO and, you know, the legislature, you know, put, you know, someone in charge, and there's much more light focused on the problem, and hopefully, you know, this will make, you know, a significant difference. And our recommendations, you know, pretty simple at this point: fix it. We want you know, the state data center to fix it, to put the things in that they need, you know, that not only we've told them, but the federal government has told them, and everyone else has told them, do it. And the only way they can do that is, you know, by taking that first step, which we believe they've taken. And that first step is to put someone in responsible, put someone in charge, and get the human resources and, you know, the support from not only the legislature, but from state agencies to go forward and to do that. Do you have any questions, or should we just go to dinner?
Questions?
Dinner sounds good.
Yeah.
Dinner sounds good. So thank you very much. And I think that one of the things that my goal is to have this body, the legislature, making sure that we continue on the path that Alex and his staff have started and get it done. So I'm looking forward to. Oh, and by the way, one question: have you done an audit on the Secretary of State's security?
An audit of the Secretary of State's security, Chair Riley. One of the things that we can't do as auditors is audit ourselves. And so, you know, that would be the answer there. I've, you know,
has one been done?
Chair Riley, that would be a question for my boss.
Who audits?
I will be asking that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's why we need that legislative audit.
So I'm going to close this informational hearing, and one of the things I want to do before we go is to ask the members of the committee to think about anything that they want us to look at in future meetings, and to think about anything that you think might be a good committee bill for the future. So anything for the good of the order? From thank you very much. We are adjourned. Adjourned.